How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me,
the genes of you and me,
we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA. We're all made of DNA.
Hi, you're listening to DNA Today, a multi-award-winning podcast and radio show where we discover new advances in the world of genetics. From genetic technology like CRISPR to rare diseases to new research, for over a decade, DNA Today has brought you the voices of leaders in genetics in over 200 episodes. For the past 3 years, DNA Today has won the People's Choice Best Science and Medicine Podcast Award. I'm Kira Dineen. I'm a certified genetic counselor and your host. We're learning about two reproductive genetic topics today: pre-implantation genetic testing for aneuploidy, also known as PGTA, and genetic testing of miscarriages, also known as products of conception or POC. Joining me for this conversation is genetic counselor Kelly Loggenberg. She is currently the in-house genetic counselor at Next Biosciences, which is a female-led South African biotechnology company with a focus in reproductive genetic testing. So thank you so much, Kelly, for coming on. We have quite the time difference, so I appreciate you making time to come on DNA Today.
Yeah, I feel like it might be really early in your morning time, so thank you for having me and accommodating the time differences. I really appreciate that.
Oh, of course. I'm sipping my coffee. I know it's more like your mid-afternoon over there. I think it's about 3 o'clock there, 8 a.m. here in New York. But yeah, thanks so much for coming on. As many people that listened to DNA Today know, I'm also a prenatal genetic counselor. So I really like when I actually get to talk about the area of genetics that I work in. You have much more of an extensive background. I've been in clinic for a little over 3 years, but you beat me way beyond that. So, Kelly, with your extensive background in genetic counseling and your role at Next Biosciences, can you provide an overview of PGTA and how it fits into reproductive genetic testing? Because some people may know of this, but you know a little bit more than, you know, the average patient, or I would dare even say the average genetic counselor.
Sure. So PGTA is essentially a test that we do on early stage embryos, so typically day five embryos, where a few cells are removed, and then we do NGS-based testing to look for aneuploidy, so chromosome abnormalities. And the idea really is to add this into the IVF process so that clinicians can use it as an embryo selection tool. So it assists them when deciding out of a cohort of embryos which should be considered for transfer, because we know that embryos that have chromosome abnormalities or aneuploidies are not going to lead to a successful pregnancy. So by screening for that and then choosing your euploid embryos, or those with normal chromosomes, 46, as we typically expect, that gives the patient a much higher chance of a successful IVF outcomes per embryo transfer.
And it can be appropriate in some cases, and in some cases, it may not be as appropriate to do PGTA. What are some of the reasons why a person or a couple, depending on, you know, their situation, why they would say, you know what, let's do PGTA? One of the aspects for me that I'm thinking about is cost. I mean, it can be expensive, but what are medical reasons that it makes sense to be looking at that as a cost? Because, you know, I don't know about in South Africa, but in the US, you know, most of the time that's not covered by insurance. So that's a factor, unfortunately, when it comes to decision-making with reproductive genetic testing and options that we're doing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So unfortunately, we're in a similar position where this kind of testing and even your IVF treatment is not covered by medical insurers. So cost is certainly a factor. I think that while we know there can be benefit for many couples who are doing IVF to consider PGTA as an addition, there are certain individuals or couples who may benefit perhaps slightly more. And where we see this is where the female partner is perhaps slightly older. So we know that there is this correlation between advancing female age and an increased risk of these sporadic chromosome abnormalities that we can see. Certainly, every couple will have a different fertility journey. And for couples who have perhaps experienced multiple pregnancy losses, they may choose to include PGTA to have information about the chromosome makeup of an embryo prior to transfer, because by having that, you're reducing the risk of miscarriage quite significantly. So that's a really important factor for many couples. And then we have the other ones, like, for example, where there's a known sex-linked condition where PGTA can then be really useful. So those are probably the three categories where we see it as quite significant benefit.
Yeah, I agree with that. I see patients once they're done with fertility, and we kind of say that they've graduated from fertility and are now joining a pregnancy practice. And at that point, you know, I'm going over, okay, this is what you've had to this point with genetic testing. And one of the aspects that I go over is if they would like to do a genetic screening now that they're pregnant, called non-invasive prenatal screening or non-invasive prenatal testing, NIPS, NIPT, goes by the different acronyms and names there. But I think it's important. One of the aspects I talk about with patients is, well, this is what PGTA covers, and this is the percent chance that it could have missed a condition, because it's not 100%. But then what the conditions are extra with NIPS that we're not routinely looking at when we do PGTA. Is that information you talk about with patients too, or is that more you hope that genetic counselors like me are covering it on my end?
So a little bit of both. And I think that it's so important to have informed decision-making at every point. So knowing exactly what your PGTA test can tell you, what information can it give you, and what can't it give you? So what things may miss? And I think, so certainly when I speak to patients pre-test, those are the kind of things that I do try to address. The reality in South Africa is that most patients don't see a genetic counselor pre-test, so pre having the PGT. They will have that discussion with their clinician, so their fertility doctor. But in the small number of cases where perhaps they do see a genetic counselor, I try to make the point that we're testing quite a small sample size, so we're taking a few cells from the embryo. And while it's a good representation and is reliable in most cases, it can never give us that 100% guarantee. So if there is an established pregnancy, you may still want to consider things like NIPT, which is the acronym we use locally. So you may still want to consider your NIPT, because there are also some other conditions. So depending on what your NIPT provider offers, that you may not pick up on PGTA because of the limit of detection. So smaller things like microdeletion syndromes, you won't necessarily see on PGTA. So it's important that you correlate your pregnancy and scan findings and how the pregnancy is progressing with what's then offered during a pregnancy. So NIPT may still be a good option for somebody who has had a PGTA to consider following a discussion, hopefully with a genetic counselor like yourself, in that prenatal setting.
Yeah, certainly. I think you bring up a good point too. Just in South Africa, there are much less genetic counselors per, you know, citizen or person, pregnant person. So that's, you know, I imagine a factor. And, you know, we in the US, a lot of people that are pregnant do see a genetic counselor, but not necessarily everybody, because it depends at what point in your pregnancy you start seeking medical care and different aspects there. But I think it is important to know, it's like, you know, these are screenings. It is not a diagnostic test at this point.
That needs to be made very clear from the outset. And I think the problem, as you mentioned, there are only about, I think, between 30 and 35 of us practicing in South Africa. So if you and look at the breakdown of sort of how we cover the population and people that will be having these tests, we know we're just not getting to everyone. So we try and do a lot of education of clinicians as well to be able to then pick up on that information during their consultations, because the reality is most patients probably won't see a genetic counselor.
Yeah, definitely. And we've had a couple of your colleagues on the show, so we'll have to talk after the show. But I'll put that link in the show notes if people want to learn more about genetic counseling in South Africa. We kind of have an episode just about the field. So I'll link to that, because I can't remember the number of it off the top of my head. But kind of going along with this, you know, on your side, when you're talking with people that are saying, okay, we think we're going to go through with IVF and, you know, we're considering PGTA, what are some of the challenges or ethical considerations associated with this pre-implantation genetic testing? I mean, how do you navigate these conversations with patients? Or is it more you're offering it and it's more thoughts you're having and conversations you're having with colleagues in terms of those, you know, ethical challenges and considerations?
So I think both. And I think, so certainly there's a lot of discussion amongst colleagues and between genetic counselors and clinicians, so the fertility doctors who are offering these tests to patients. But I think some of the things that come up very often with patients from a perhaps more challenging point of view currently with PGT, and PGTA in particular, is mosaic embryos and how you navigate that situation. And you could do a whole show just about embryo mosaicism and how to deal with that. But, you know, addressing that upfront, and I think making patients aware that that is a possibility and knowing what the possible outcomes of the test could be. So it may not be as clear as a euploid or aneuploid embryo. There is this sort of other category that we need to address. And there are many different schools of thought around mosaic embryos and what we should be doing with them. And in South Africa, we've tended to be a little more conservative. And it's only in the last few years that we've actively been considering mosaic embryos for transfer. And I think that correlates nicely with the research that we've seen that's been published sort of about mosaic embryos. So we very much, and our clinicians here very much tend to sort of look to evidence based sort of what does the literature say, what is happening internationally. So that's certainly one of the more challenging things that we face. But then also making it clear that there is no test that can give you all the answers that you are looking for, and that can give you that guarantee of an absolutely healthy pregnancy and child. And I think it's just making sure, again, it comes back to the point that I mentioned earlier about informed decision-making, informed consent, and knowing this upfront, or then once results are available, making those informed decisions about embryo transfer and whether you're going to consider it or not and what your options are around that.
The mosaic embryos are so interesting because we imagine they happen even in naturally conceived pregnancies, spontaneous pregnancies, but we've just come such a long way technology that we can actually identify that in embryos in the lab. And we've been implanting mosaic embryos in the US, I don't know how long, but you know, at least for a few years since I've been practicing. But it seems to be the cases that are implanted are low-level mosaicism. So it's only a tiny part of the of the sampling of the cells that we get that actually do have that genetic change or chromosomal change. And that it also involves chromosomes that aren't well-known genetic conditions that we know, like such as Down syndrome, where we're like, oh, if there is an extra chromosome 21, there is that potential for that, you know, pregnancy to develop into a baby that has Down syndrome. So it's a very fascinating conversation. I agree with you. Mosaic embryos, I think we've come a long way with that. But, you know, every country is different in terms of like, are we actually implanting those or not? And every practice is even different in the US. I think some are like, you know what, we don't recommend that. We're not going to go ahead and do that. And others are like, we're leaving it up to a patient if it's that low level and, you know, chromosomes that aren't necessarily a, you know, well-known genetic condition.
Yeah, so I think here we see the same. There's variability within clinics here. So you can see different doctors at the same practice, fertility doctors at the same practice with different views on whether they will transfer mosaic embryos or not. Will they only transfer low levels or will they consider high levels for transfer? So, you know, and I think that we have good evidence now to say that these embryos do have good reproductive potential, but perhaps we should, well, I strongly believe there should be a discussion with a genetic counselor prior to transfer, because it's a nuanced discussion that needs to be had with the couple or the individual considering transfer that's unique to their situation, the chromosomes that are involved, the level of mosaicism, sort of as you say, high versus low level, what has been shown to be the potential for those embryos. Because no couple is going to make the same decision. For some couple, another IVF cycle may be better for them. But for others, cost is such a factor here that if they know that there is potential, good reproductive potential for a mosaic embryo, that may be their best chance. And as long as they sort of understand the complexities, I certainly feel that it's something that really it's progressed a lot in the years that I've been doing this. We've come a long way. It's a really interesting part of the field to me.
Yeah, I imagine it must be so cool to just see how much has changed in your career. Genetics moves so wicked fast. Even just the changes I've seen since the start of this show 11 years ago. Yeah. It's wild. It's really exciting. But I think for listeners, that's definitely a topic that if you want to go down a rabbit hole, I recommend kind of going and reading papers about mosaic embryos. I also wanted to talk about another area of expertise for you in this reproductive genetic testing space, and that's doing testing on miscarriages. So what we call clinically products of conception, so tissue from miscarriages. What situations might individuals or couples opt for this genetic testing? What are the circumstances around that, that, you know, in terms of collecting a sample, like what do you talk about with patients in terms of POC testing?
So from a personal point of view, I feel like this is one of the tests, that genetic tests in this space, that adds the most value to patients. Because very often when there is an early pregnancy loss, the first thing that is asked is why? Why did this happen? Did I do something wrong? Was it something I did or didn't do? Was it a medication that I was on or something that was part of my diet? And I think that we know that internationally and even again locally, there are different recommendations for when you start to consider this kind of testing on products of conception. But essentially what we do with POC testing, as we call it locally, is we again screening the tissue from a miscarriage for chromosome abnormalities, because we know that in about half of early pregnancy losses, so 50%, you will find a chromosome abnormality. And in most of those cases, it's a sporadic event that has happened. It's often not inherited, which is then really important information for that couple or individual to be aware of, because it provides an explanation for why that loss happened. It allows them to process that information. And in many cases, when I speak to patients after testing, once we have results available, it provides so much reassurance going into a next pregnancy in terms of the future risks for another pregnancy, because we know, because most of these abnormalities are sporadic, the recurrence risk is actually quite low. So they feel more comfortable, they're less worried going into another pregnancy. And in the very small number of cases, so if you find something on products of conception testing that alludes to the fact that there could be a translocation or a chromosome rearrangement in one of the couple, one of the partners, that's really valuable information, because then you can take it a step further and you can do the chromosome analysis so that you then have accurate recurrence risks. And certainly I just, from a psychological benefit perspective, I think it's one of the tests that we offer that really has such tremendous value. And it's one that I feel should be offered after every pregnancy loss. Again, cost is an issue. We realize that. And there are different guidelines internationally. So some recommendations say start considering testing after a second loss or a third loss. But when sitting in a room, so recently at a it was sort of a support group type event, where, but it was an academic presentations, education, when asking a room full of individuals who are struggling with fertility issues, when should we start doing this kind of testing? After the second, third loss, unanimously, they said after the first loss. We need that information. We want that kind of information. So I think that it's a really valuable tool that we have in terms of managing couples that have experienced, or individuals that have experienced, a pregnancy loss. It's one of the tests that I feel very strongly about.
Yeah, I think it's great when we can do that testing right away, when we have that sample and we can see, okay, do we find any genetic changes? Because sometimes it comes back normal, which in some ways can be frustrating. When I'm calling out those results, you know, I feel for patients that you almost want to have abnormal results that were random, because it gives someone an explanation of, this is why the miscarriage happened and it was random. We don't expect this to happen again. There's a less than 1% chance of this happening again. So I think that's, in some cases, like the best results to get with just patients taking that in. But as you said, so important to know, oh, there is something that, I like the way you phrase that, of like alludes to, could be, you know, an inherited genetic change that then led to the miscarriage, such as a balanced translocation. That's a common one that we see within that small, you know, group of people where something comes up that could be inherited. But isn't it so much better to know with your first miscarriage, if that is there, than, say, after you've had three losses. I mean, just emotionally of going through that, let alone all of the medical bills that surround that. But also, I think at this point in time, people are also having, you know, children later in life. So more and more people are experiencing age-related fertility issues. So it's like, let's learn sooner. You know, I would say my average patient is, as we, you know, you use the term advanced maternal age, advanced female age. So as eggs get older, we have, you know, the way I explain it to patients is like they have a harder time counting the chromosomes and they miscount. So I think that is really important. In your setting, do people, if someone miscarries at home, are they able to bring in that sample to you? Is it more of if they have had a miscarriage and then they're having a follow-up procedure to remove the rest of the pregnancy tissue? You know, how does that usually work? Because in our case, we can do both. But I wonder how that works, if there's any differences just with your patient population or also just, you know, being on the other side of the world too.
Certainly, we also do both. I think the majority of patients, we get samples following a follow-up procedure that's been done by their clinician. But we do have instances where when products are passed at home, if they feel able to collect that themselves and take it into their healthcare provider, that gets sent to the laboratory for testing. So certainly it's something that's possible. But I would say probably the majority of cases that we get, the sample is taken when there's a follow-up procedure that's done.
Yeah.
So it sounds pretty similar to your setting.
Yeah, I think so. I certainly have some patients that will come in that, you know, it's kind of like a blood clot that they've passed. So, and, you know, they're kind of just collecting that and bringing that in. And that's, you know, because I know a lot of students will ask me, well, how is that actually? Like, how does that work? And, you know, for just having insight there. But I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you, Kelly, just about, you know, you earned your master's in genetic counseling from the University of Cape Town, which is one of the programs in South Africa. Then you worked as a genetic counselor in the UK for a decade. So you've got quite the international experience and perspective. You know, with those years of working with different patient populations in different parts of the world, what have you noticed in terms of, you know, if there are differences between people utilizing PGTA, just, you know, the opinions and thoughts surrounding that, the types of questions you get from patients, and also, you know, products of conception that we've been talking about too. Is there any differences you've seen between regions or countries?
So what I would probably say is the most significant difference is probably that the time that I spent in the UK tends to be, so again, there you need to bear in mind again, just for context, I suppose, is that they have the NHS, the National Health System. So most people are able to access their healthcare through the NHS, and very few people pay for healthcare privately. So because they have a national healthcare system, it tends to be very guideline oriented. So there needs to be clear guidelines about when certain tests are offered. So there, for example, if the guideline says you only do POC testing after a second or third loss, that is your option. That is what you're going to be doing. So a woman would have to sort of go through those experiences, and only at the point when you kind of meet the guideline or criteria would you be able to offer products of conception testing. Where locally, there certainly are guidelines and different clinicians will adhere to them in different ways. But if a patient were to request that, or if a clinician felt after a first loss they wanted to request a products of conception testing, that would be absolutely fine. Because again, and I suppose I should sort of add context here, in South Africa, we also have sort of two very different healthcare systems. We have a public healthcare system, and this may have been alluded to sort of in the previous episode that you did. And then we have a private healthcare system. So patients that have medical insurance and that have their healthcare in that way. And most of the discussion that I've been having and the tests that I'm talking about would sit into that, in that category of patients that are paying through insurance providers for their healthcare. Again, with PGT in the UK, PGTA is not routinely offered in the UK. Again, because it doesn't meet that sort of the guidelines and the criteria that is there. So I think those are probably the biggest differences. So when I worked in the UK, I didn't actually do a lot of fertility work. It was only sort of, it was more cancer-based work that I did at that point in my career. And then as I sort of transitioned back to South Africa, that fertility and reproductive genetics became a focus. But I think that's certainly the biggest difference. And I think that speaks sort of to all things, really, is that different countries with different healthcare systems will operate in different ways. And where patient choice comes in will depend on the healthcare setting that you're in.
It's almost similar to Canada, too, for in terms of just with their healthcare system, it is universal healthcare. So very, very similar, a lot of parallels to the UK of just, you know, and certainly all countries have certain guidelines and, you know, that we have that in cancer and prenatal and all that. And then the insurance companies will kind of look at those guidelines and be like, all right, what are we going to cover? What are we not going to cover? But then it's all different depending on, you know, the different insurance companies. But then people can also say, we want to pay out of pocket. But it's interesting just seeing how that can affect how many people actually utilize some of this testing. And if they're not eligible for it through like those country guidelines of having insurance through their country, and that's what most people do, then they're just not going to have that. So it's interesting that patients that are doing IVF, say in the UK, they probably don't do PGTA versus, you know, you pick a random patient in the US that did IVF, you know, if we say they're 40 years old or something, they've probably done PGTA. So it's just so interesting to see the changes there.
I think certainly in the UK, IVF is offered on the NHS, but many patients do pay privately to have their IVF treatment. And I think those patients will be offered PGTA. But if they're doing their IVF with through the NHS, they probably wouldn't be offered PGTA. And I think that raises a whole different discussion again, you know.
Yeah, disparity of care, who can afford it, and, you know, and
absolutely,
you know, definitely we've done many episodes kind of focus on that. We need to do many more. But yeah, just as we close out, are there any things that you think about in terms of the future of reproductive genetic technology and kind of the testing that we've talked about? I mean, I think in terms of the last, I don't know, I want to say 12 years, you know, we've had NIPS. Like that was huge. 2011, 2012 is kind of when the show started, actually, is when that started being used. And then, you know, over the years, it's really been clinically adopted in so many places. It's become a standard and it's replaced a lot of other like quad screening and first trimester screening that we don't see as much. But again, depends on where someone is in the world and what their insurance is covering. So that's a big part. But is there anything that you kind of see of like, wow, this is the next testing that is just, you know, we're really excited about, or a technique with it? You know, we've come a long way in terms of just, you know, where we are today.
I think that for me and the setting where we kind of find ourselves here is there've been so many advances, and NIPT is obviously one of the big ones. And then the introduction of NGS as well, where you're able to sort of report, and what you're able to do is just so much better. And I think as things evolve and improve, yes, we're able to offer much more specialized testing. But I think for me, what I'm hoping for going forward is that we're going to be able to improve access, that we're going to be able to bring costs down, and that we're going to be able to improve access to things like NIPT and all the other tests that we offer, so that you don't have these disparities anymore, because certainly in South Africa, that's a big problem for us. So as much as I find research very exciting and looking at sort of the new technologies that are coming for PGT, so looking at whole genome sequencing of embryos, really exciting from a research perspective. But for me, what I'm hoping for is that we're going to be able to reduce costs so that we can have more patients accessing these tests, and that as the technology evolves, you'll be able to bring the price down. And, you know, that's really what I'm hoping for, and that as technology evolves, that will be the end point for us.
That's a beautiful answer. I think it's disheartening that we have this awesome technology, but not everybody can use it. So I think kind of playing catch up with that is fantastic. I mean, technology, you know, we see like, you know, getting a flat screen TV was a huge deal, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago. And now everybody has one, right? I got one behind me. You know, I think it's exciting that the cost, especially when we're looking at sequencing and other things, we've seen that just dramatically drop. You know, since we did the Human Genome Project 20 years ago, that we finished that first draft of the human genome. And now like that costs, I don't know, millions in there, you know, something like that. And now you can pay a couple hundred dollars and have your genome sequenced. And it's wild. It really is exciting. But having that be available to more people is really what is exciting about that. So I love that. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Kelly, for coming on. And it's just so interesting to hear your perspective with, you know, going to school in South Africa, going out to the UK and experiencing that for a decade in genetic counseling, and then coming back to South Africa, and just everything that you know about PGT-A and POC testing. I mean, I think there's just so much available in the reproductive space that it's just fantastic that patients, you know, hopefully can take advantage of this, or at least be educated about it. So thank you so much, Kelly. Really appreciate it.
Such a pleasure. It's such an exciting area to work in. So I really do enjoy it.
Yes, definitely. Oh, and I did look up the episode as we were chatting. So some of your colleagues were on episode 221 for people that want to check that out. We talked about the genetic counseling, career and field in South Africa. So I think that pairs well with this episode that you were kind of referring to.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So guys, check that out. We'll put that in the show notes. And thanks again, Kelly.
Thank you so much.
For more information about today's episode, visit dnatoday.com, where you can also stream all 200 plus episodes of the show, including video versions of interviews recorded in 2021 or later. Any questions, episode ideas, guest pitches, or sponsor inquiries can be sent into info@dnatoday.com. Be sure to follow us on social media, especially so you don't miss a giveaway. We are at DNA Today Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, and more. Please rate and review the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. This truly helps us climb the charts and allow more genetic nerds like yourself to find the show. Here's a bonus. If you do and send us a screenshot, I'll give you a shout out on the show. DNA Today is created, hosted, and produced by myself, Kira Dineen. Our team includes communications lead, Corinne Merlino, video lead, Amanda Andrioli, outreach intern, Sonia Tanaker, social media intern, Kajal Patel, and graphic designer, Ashlyn Anokian. Thanks for listening, and join us next time to discover new advances in the world of genetics.
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.